The U.S. and Europe are intensifying efforts to deter Russia from invading Ukraine. The Pentagon has readied some 8,500 troops for possible deployment to the region. NATO has sent more ships and fighter jets. So what happens next? Well, our next guest suggests a long view of Russia and the former Soviet Union and its history can provide some clues. Anne Applebaum is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and her newest book is Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. Anne, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So to kind of frame this, I want to get your long view of this moment here. A lot of the conversation about Ukraine has been about Vladimir Putin, how it's important to him that Russia maintain this influence over Ukraine to remove Ukraine from the map, as you have written. But as you see it, does this go much further back to Soviet and pre-Soviet Russia?
There's a very old and long tradition of Russians seeing Ukraine as essentially a colony, dating back to the Tsarist Empire. Stalin actually saw Ukraine as a major problem for him. At the time of the Russian Revolution, the Russian Empire, as it was, broke up into parts. There was a civil war. And for one period during that time, there was a kind of independent government in Ukraine. And for Stalin, this was a huge threat. He saw Ukrainian sovereignty as a threat to the Bolshevik Revolution, as a threat to him personally. And he instigated what turned into a major crackdown on Ukraine and eventually resulted in an artificial famine that killed many people. And the reason I'm telling you all that is because there is an echo in the present, in that Putin sees Ukraine not just as a, you know, as a sort of irritant or a problem the way, you know, lots of countries find their neighbors, you know, bothersome. He sees Ukraine as a kind of existential threat.
Mm-hmm.
If Ukraine were to be a successful independent country, if it were to be a democracy, if it were to be prosperous, if it were to be integrated into Europe, that would be a threat to Putin's own regime, because it would pose a kind of ideological challenge. Look, here's a different way of running Ukraine, and that would be a challenge to Russia, and Russians might look at Ukraine and say, hey, we'd like to have that too.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Stalin in that period. You have written a book about this, kind of remind the rest of us about this brief Ukrainian independence moment in the early 20th century and how, as you write, Stalin retaliated, resulting in the famine.
Yeah, so I did write a book about the famine. It's called Red Famine. And one of the things I discovered when researching the famine was that it's not really a history of the famine. It's the short years in the early 1930s when the famine actually takes place are only explained by, as I said, this earlier history that Ukraine was a problem for Stalin, that he couldn't tame Ukraine, the Ukrainian peasantry didn't accept the Bolshevik regime. And so he felt he had to somehow crush Ukraine. And one of the tools that he used, he used repression of intellectuals and he arrested many Ukrainians, including Ukrainian communists. But he also organized an artificial famine, which was not the result of, you know, a drought or a food shortage. Literally, food was taken out of people's houses. And the result was, it's very hard to calculate the precise number of deaths, but it's between 3 and 4 million. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's left a mark in Ukraine's national memory to this day. It's a very important and significant moment. And, you know, most Ukrainians don't remember this as a Russian action. They remember it as a Soviet action. But, you know, Putin, by doing what he's doing now, is certainly evoking that memory once again.
Mm-hmm. You know, as I read this, I thought about the Great Famine in China. I was based in China for a number of years and an estimated, you know, somewhere between 36 million or 44 million people in China died in the late 50s and early 60s. As you know, my own relatives talked about eating tree bark to survive. At the time, the outside world didn't know. And similarly, in Ukraine, the outside world didn't know what was happening at the time. But you also write this was covered up, not just by the Soviets, but with the help of the New York Times.
Yes. Unfortunately, there was a New York Times correspondent in Moscow at the time who did know the famine was unfolding and spoke about it privately, but chose not to write about it. And in fact, chose to kind of mock and belittle one of the other journalists who did write about it. There was a British Welsh journalist called Gareth Jones who went to Ukraine during the middle of the famine. And the New York Times correspondent was called Walter Duranty. He wasn't alone, actually. It should be said that most of the Moscow press corps was at that time, they were many of them were kind of boosters of the Soviet system, and they wanted to see it succeed. Hmm. But many diplomats, many people in the region, the Catholic Church, many of the Ukraine's neighbors did know there was something happening, but it wasn't well understood. It was something that was taking place far away. You know, it's really analogous to North Korea now. I mean, we know bad things happen there. And that's another reason, though, of course, that Ukraine is very sensitive as to how it is perceived and how its history is perceived, because they know that tragedies there have not necessarily moved Europe and America in the past.
Hmm. Which takes us to today's tension over Ukraine. On this day, as we talk, there is furious diplomacy. There are kind of military preparations. And you have written that the best time to offer Ukraine military support would have been 8 years ago. Why?
Well, 8 years ago was the time of the first Russian invasion of Ukraine. So remember, Russia has already invaded Ukraine. They invaded Crimea, which they occupied and annexed, and they invaded eastern Ukraine, the two provinces in eastern Ukraine, which they where there's an ongoing war and where there has been a war for 8 years. And so the time to think about reinforcing Ukraine against further Russian incursion was really 2014, 2015, but then over the past, you know, 4 to 5 to 6 years as well. The Obama administration didn't ever take this problem seriously. Obama didn't believe that Russia was a real problem for the United States or a real challenge. And Trump, of course, favored Russia. You know, he tried to use Ukrainian, the military assistance the U.S. has given to Ukraine, he tried to use that as a kind of bargaining chip. If you remember the impeachment, you know, the impeachment trial, he tried to use that as a bargaining chip to get the Ukrainians to give him some fake dirt on Joe Biden. The Biden administration has been pretty good. I mean, there has been a big chunk of military assistance over the past year, you know, but what Ukraine, the kinds of things Ukraine needs, you know, big defensive systems, you know, anti-aircraft systems, you know, anti-tank weapons and all that is still, they still lack quite a lot of it. The Ukrainian army has improved a great deal. It's not what it was in 2014. Nevertheless, the time to think about Russian grand strategy in the region and to have our own strategy in response to it, you know, really was over the last several years and not starting right now.
And finally, Anne, you were in Kyiv earlier this month and you wrote that from Kyiv, the perspective is that the Western attitude toward Russia and its intentions looks naive. Why? Is that because in a lot of the West, you know, leaders have not paid enough attention to this history you write about?
People haven't paid enough attention to the history, and people in particularly in Europe, but also in the United States, they just can't believe that somebody would start a land war in Europe now. That idea belongs to the distant past. You know, the idea of, you know, a cruel autocracy seeking to dominate its neighbors, this, again, seems to them to belong to a different era. You know, and also the degree to which the Russians think about and seek to influence politics in Europe and in the United States also seems to them kind of unreal and impossible. I mean, unfortunately, when you look at what Russia actually does, it's all too real and it's all too possible. But the Western instinct, you know, I mean, I think it's maybe a human instinct, is to say this can't be happening. It's not true. And unfortunately, that's harmed our ability to prepare and to think about what Russia might want and how Russia might behave over the next years and even decades. And it's hampered our ability to prepare for exactly the kind of circumstance that we're in now, where there are Russian troops all around the border, where there are clear invasion plans that people in Washington have seen. We still don't know, I should emphasize, whether Putin will go through with this or not. Mm-hmm. Many people also do believe, and there's reason to think that's a possibility, that he's bluffing and this is all a game to get some Western concessions or Ukrainian concessions. But nevertheless, the possibility of a real war remains there. It's still on the table and it has to be taken seriously.
Anne Applebaum is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Anne, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks very much.